Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update, an original podcast from Charles Schwab, provides an information-packed daily market recap in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. He has darkened the door. He's a gentleman always of interest. I'm up to 14 emails. Ask him about the president. We'll do that later. We'll get to Mr. Trump and Mr. Schwartzman's support of those of the political persuasions. I guess the text is good, but what it takes, lessons in the pursuit of excellence from S.A. Schwartzman. He works for a shop called Blackstone. Just the photos are outstanding. Yeah. Congratulations on the courage of showing a younger Steve Schwartzman. Who put them together?
Well, that's certainly different than what I look like in the mirror when I'm shaving in the morning, Tom.
If you are of a certain persuasion, Paul, you're too young for this. There was a battle in the 60s, and this is where your real governance and leadership clicked in. You're the one at Yale that got it so the other sex could visit the other sex's dorm rooms, right?
Yes,
pariahs.
That was a leadership lesson, right?
That was.
Give us a vignette of that battle.
That was a very popular lesson. I was dating a local girl, and so I thought more access was a good idea. For 278 years, Yale had a policy that women could not be in the dorms after certain times at night.
4 p.m.
And for certain days. So I thought that needed to be changed. My view is that perhaps we should get rid of those restrictions. But I knew if I went to the administration and sort of asked for that, if it had worked one way for 278 years, it was going to continue to be that way. They'd have a series of excuses that you know, we'd be interrupting students' study. There'd be music going on in the dorms all the time,
and it would change. Everybody playing Disraeli Girls Cream. How'd you get this done?
Well, it wasn't so hard, actually. I put together a survey of all the possible ways that somebody could object to just abolishing what was called parietal hours and restrictions on parietals. And I got 11 of my friends to stand outside the dining rooms at Yale. They handed out the form. After the meal, it was a dinner, people put the form in a basket. They delivered all the forms to me. We tabulated them, and we found that, I think it was like 99.6% of the students had no problem of any type abolishing
this.
Right. Shocking.
There was a person in my college named Reed Hunt, who ended up as head of the FCC, who was the deputy manager of the Yale Daily News. And I gave it to Reed, and I said, why don't we put it on the front page? And we did.
Oh, listen to you.
And 4 days later, the administration dropped all those restrictions.
The governor's lesson by data. Data, it sounds like M. Bloomberg. I should mention that Mr. Bloomberg is a principal owner of this TV and radio shop as well. Paul?
So, Steve, what it takes, lessons in the pursuit of excellence. Give us your thought process behind kind of, I want to write this book. This is what I want to put in this book. What were you thinking about?
Well, what triggered this was a meeting I had with the head of a sovereign wealth fund in the Middle East who was new in his job, and I was supposed to have a five-minute handshake, and he started asking me questions about how does he make his organization more like ours, in effect? How does he make it better? How does he increase the performance? How does he look at the type of people to be hiring? What kind of incentive programs would you need? How do you figure out where in the world you should be investing? What type of investments within that should you be doing? How often should you relook at your assumptions of what's going on in the world? And so it was 2.5 hours. All I was trying to do was sell him some Blackstone products. And he in the middle of it, he said, look, don't try and sell me anything. We're going to buy them anyhow.
Okay.
I don't want my time wasted. And so that was sort of interesting, but it's the kind of thing I know because I run a company, so no. I know those things. So anyhow, over the next year, most of my time, instead of being able to sell products, was taken up with this type of advice that people wanted.
Right, right.
So I realized I was getting tired doing the same type of of meeting. And I said, you know, if we write a book, I could just give them the book and they could learn it. And then I could have either shorter meetings or different ones.
Well, it's a very, very, if you're just joining us, Stephen Schwarzman with us, of course, Chairman, Chief Executive Officer, and with Pete Peterson, the co-founders of Blackstone, What It Takes: Lessons in the Pursuit of Excellence.
So it's interesting. I just think of all the alumni coming out of the old Lehman Brothers, and it's just extraordinary. It's like I'm a Salomon Brothers alum. It's the same type of thing, some of those names. You and Pete Peterson, when you left Lehman to form Blackstone, I can't imagine you thought it would be what it has become, Blackstone has become. What was your initial goal and ambitions for Blackstone?
My initial goal was to have the same feeling as I had at Lehman, which was being, you know, sort of intellectually stimulated all the time, doing a variety of different types of projects, and I just wanted to recreate that. And indeed we have, but at a scale that was not particularly contemplated exactly when you started.
How many employees do you have now?
Well, with our companies, it's around 500,000. You know, our parent company is roughly 2,500.
On the private equities, Paul mentions a transition from Lehman, which I'm going to suggest was a visible regulatory entity, to private finance, private equity, maybe on a 19th century basis, merchant banking.
Right.
Would you support more scrutiny of activities of someone that controls the employment of 500,000 people?
Well, we are supervised. We report to the SEC, and you know, it was fascinating, Tom, that during the financial crisis, which was somewhat of a proof of concept,
you guys weren't the ones that caused it. Would be the headline.
Not only did we not cause it, we basically had almost no problems. Interestingly, the companies that got in trouble, for the most part, were the regulatory companies that were controlled by regulators. So this concept of don't you need more regulation, having gone through the crisis with flying colors, watching the world around me collapsing, it's hard empirically to make the case regulation per se is an absolute good.
And Paul, this is a huge deal because it's easy to talk about in 2019. I have the clearest memories of 05, 06. It's going to be those guys. And it wasn't those guys. It was them guys. That was a huge emotion.
I mean, there were some bad deals. There were some bad deals done in 2006, 2007.
Not by
Steve. Too much leverage. Steve, one of the things we hear now, you know, we think about 2019 and we had... It was supposed to be the great year of the great IPOs, and we've had a lot of disappointments. Uber, Lyft, we've had deals that have been pulled, such as WeWork and Endeavor. And it's kind of raising the question, private market valuations, public market valuations, who's got it right, who's got it wrong? And people are now saying, gee, maybe the private market, the venture capital market, too much money, chasing too few deals, pushing up valuations, and the public market just ain't buying it. How do you kind of react to that theory?
Well, I think you're absolutely right as it pertains to a very narrow group of companies, which are venture capital financed businesses in technology. This has happened before, as you probably remember, in 1999, 2000, we had these sky-high valuations that basically got both in the private market and the public market, led to collapse. And at that point, roughly 99 out of 100 venture capital deals collapsed in technology. In the venture world, there's an odd phenomena that if you put your money in on a first round and you pay more for the second round, you've made an instant profit on the first round. If there's a third round and you make it go up even more, then you make a lot of money from both the first round and the second round. So there's an incentive, perverse incentive, if you will, that paying higher prices than you would want, as long as you were in that investment in the first place.
Yeah, but you're not in that game, right?
No, we're not in that game. And so what's happened is the values of those type of companies have been bid up by other venture capital companies. When they pop out in the public market, the public market looks at it and said, what have you guys done with these valuations?
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Steve Schwartzman with us. What It Takes is his wonderful new book. Phenomenal photographs, off the chart. Mrs. Schwartzman said, we're putting all the photos in there. Sandy Weill did that. You're going to do it too, Steve. Okay, so great. Let's cut to the chase. Weed Disaster is out there. They loaded the boat on Lord & Taylor. When you were a kid with a dry goods store, you dreamed of walking in Lord & Taylor. What are you going to do? Blackstone's going to pick it up for 18 cents in the dollar? I mean, are you going to pick up the debris worldwide of WeDog?
Well, what I'd say is our job in our real estate business is always to buy value. We call it buy it, fix it, sell it. And if you could buy something at a very reasonable price, and it's susceptible of being fixed, and we do it, that's why we've had sky-high returns in real estate for 25 years, and virtually no losses.
Well, let me cut to this. This is a serious question. Is the We Company debacle so tangible it can harm commercial real estate in this nation?
Well, I think in certain cities where they've been huge, concentrated takers of leases or buyers of buildings, it'll definitely have an effect because they've gone in very big in relatively few cities. And you would expect when things, sort of wash out for them a bit, there'll be things to buy.
So, Steve, we in the financial media here pay a lot of attention to what's going on in the trade negotiations, as I'm sure you do and your portfolio companies do as well. We have the Chinese in Washington, D.C. right now. What would you like to really see get solved, if anything can get solved here over the next several days with the Chinese in trade?
Well, it was interesting. I'm sitting in the studio here at Bloomberg, and they have television screens up, and I just saw Vice Premier Liu He walking into trade representative's office with Bob Lighthizer, who's the trade representative for the United States, and Steve Mnuchin, who's the Treasury Secretary. So whatever I think actually doesn't really matter because the action's going on in that room.
Folks, this is the Schwartzman Act that you get. You get this from Davos to the summer place. He's got like 8 summer places. It's just me. I'm just Steve Schwartzman. Come on. There's a photo in here of you with Mr. Xi and Mr. Trump. You have donated to the Schwartzman Scholars, which is legitimate Chinese philanthropy. The NBA's dealing with this right now. Have we broken this odd, wonderful cultural relationship with China with Mr. Trump's trade war?
I think we've certainly strained it. And that's creating a variety of difficulties around the world in terms of manufacturing, which is really declining virtually every place as a result of knock-ons, I think, on the trade war. The trade war wasn't meant to be a war. The trade war...
That's what President Trump told us. Was he wrong?
Well, I think the objective is to take a system in China that's grown up over 40 years that's been astonishingly successful for the Chinese. They've grown 3 to 4 times as much as the United States, accumulated a lot of wealth, employed enormous people and a number of people, and radically changed their country from GDP per capita of a few hundred dollars to $10,000 a person. Now, to do that, they went through a classic developing world scenario, hiding behind tariffs, relatively closed markets, centrally managed, very light intellectual property protections. Mm-hmm. And it reached the point where they're the second biggest economy in the world. Just to give you an idea, the U.S. and China together, depending upon which set of numbers you use, are between 35% and 40% of the entire world's economy. This is massively concentrated with these two countries. So when the U.S. asked China to change from being a developing economy to being like a developed
copyright and technology,
that the question for on their side is, why should I do it? Since we haven't had a trade agreement with them in 70 years, regardless of what strategy was used by mm-hmm. different presidents, will they change? The answer is yes, but at what speed and what magnitude of change over time?
But Steve Schwartzman, they're not going at Trumpian speed, and this is the money question right now. You have an exceptional relationship with the President of the United States. You've been a great fundraiser, et cetera. Do you perceive all this agony we're living, whatever our politics, is a one-off due to the president's one or two terms, or is there a persistency here of a changed world?
I think there's a persistency, Tom, that comes from the condition of the workforce in the developed world. In the United States, as you remember, 2 years ago, the Fed did a study, and it said that 40% of Americans can't write a $400 check in an emergency. In other words, 40% of Americans fundamentally have almost nothing in the way of savings. Now, those people are unhappy. Those unhappy people actually ended up electing Donald Trump, which was a surprise to virtually everyone. Mm-hmm. And those 40 people still are unhappy, as
Agreed.
You can tell
Agreed.
From the populace.
From my mail.
And so for the Chinese, which has been explained to them, that this isn't just a Donald Trump phenomenon. And I talked to them really in the first, right before the inauguration, and said, you know, the frustrations in the United States and the rest of the developed world are going to be coming at you. And it's not about a person. And it's not about an administration, because we have to make sure these people in the United States, on the bottom 40%, have a much, much better outcome. And with populism, they'll get angry at whoever they're directed to get angry against, whether it's financial companies, whether it's wealthy people, whether it's the business community.
And Steve, I think your point is very well taken, because we've seen it not just in the U.S. with Donald Trump's election, but with Brexit, obviously, and the yellow vests in France. What do you think and it's a big macro question, might be too 30,000 foot, but income inequality, how would you think U.S. policy should be to try to address that? Is that, I know as you sit down with the administration, maybe have some discussions, what do you think are some of the best ways?
Well, I think it's really important to address this because it's ripping the fabric of the United States apart politically. Yeah. And the first thing that I think needs to be addressed is the income level. For this group of people, and there are a lot of different policy responses you can have. What I like is increasing the minimum wage, and to $15, where you could afford that. Different parts of the country, that may be a little bit too high. The reason why I like that is because to get that wealth transfer, you actually have to work to get it. This isn't passive. And it's about 15% of the people in the country that would affect. Yeah. But what happens is that the people who earn more than the minimum wage, when you get close to doubling a minimum wage, they all have to be increased. So this would hit somewhere between 35 and 40% of Americans. So that's a start. Okay.
We're running out of time. Barry emails in and says, well, yes, Steve, to buy the New York Knicks and fix it. We'll see if that'll happen. I got one more question. It's really, really important. I want you to review the future of the New York Public Library. People talk, others do. You took an institution flat on its back. Bezos is making it happen with Kindle and all that. Right. Talk about why we need a library, and particularly as you have beautified that marble palace downtown.
Well, what's fascinating, counter to what everybody thought, is that attendance at libraries are going up, not down.
I think a lot of people don't know that.
Right. And the reason for that is that a lot of middle class and lower income people don't have access to the internet, and libraries have basically dived into, using digital media, and so it's a place where if you can't afford some of these devices, you can go. Secondly, people who want to do well, middle class people and lower income people, sometimes they're living in accommodations where it's there are a lot of people packed in their apartments or homes.
They can't get
and it's
the
really
peace.
Noisy.
Yeah.
And it's hard to study. And what the library provides is not only electronic connections, but in the digital world, but it provides a place where people could actually study and think.
I got 5 seconds left. Stocks up? Are you long the market?
I think stocks are nervous.
Okay, that was sounds like he's ready for radio. Steve Schwarzman, thank you so much. What It Takes, folks, a really interesting, it was going to be 800 pages, and Mr. Schwarzman said, cut it down, Stephen. What It Takes, Lessons in the Pursuit of Excellence. Short, sharp, smart, smart, smart on lessons learned. Stephen Schwarzman of Blackstone. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.